Any departure from the God of Scripture begins the long slide downward toward the loss of man's humanness. By embracing the philosophies and practices of the Canaanites as God's image bearers, Israel lost its human connection with both God and man. Modern mankind today, whether they are in or out of the church, is now on that same trajectory. This is the 38th sermon in the series on Conquest, Compromise, Judgment, and Restoration, an exposition on the book of the Judges. Our Old Covenant reading coming from Judges chapter 10, Judges chapter 10, beginning in verse 6 through verse 14. By inspiration of God, the prophet says this, "And the children of Israel did evil again in the sight of the Lord, and served Balaam and Ashtaroth, and the gods of Syria, and the gods of Zidon, and the gods of Moab, and the gods of the children of Ammon, and the gods of the Philistines, and forsook the Lord and served not him. And the anger of the Lord was hot against Israel, and he sold them into the hands of the Philistines and into the hands of the children of Ammon. And that year they vexed and oppressed the children of Israel 18 years. All the children of Israel that were on the other side, Jordan, in the land of the Amorites, which is in Gilead. Moreover, the children of Ammon passed over Jordan to fight also against Judah and against Benjamin and against the house of Ephraim, so that Israel was sore distressed. And the children of Israel cried unto the Lord, saying, We have sinned against thee, both because we have forsaken our God and also served Balaam. And the Lord said unto the children of Israel, Did not I deliver you from the Egyptians and from the Amorites, from the children of Ammon and from the Philistines? The Zidonians also, and the Amalekites and the Manoites did oppress you, and you cried to me, and I delivered you out of their hand. Yet ye have forsaken me and served other gods. Wherefore I will deliver you no more. Go and cry unto the gods which ye have chosen. Let them deliver you in the time of your tribulation." Paul writing to the church at Corinth, 2 Corinthians chapter 6, beginning in verse 14 through verse 18. And by the same Spirit that moved the prophet, so does the Spirit of God move Paul to write this. "Be ye not unequally yoked together with unbelievers. For what fellowship hath righteousness with unrighteousness? And what communion hath light with darkness? And what concord hath Christ with Belial? Or what part hath he that believeth with an infidel? And what agreement hath the temple of God with idols? For ye are the temple of the living God. As God hath said, I will dwell in them and walk in them, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. Wherefore, come out from among them, and be ye separate, saith the Lord. And touch not the unclean thing, and I will receive you, and will be a father unto you, and ye shall be my sons and daughters, saith the Lord Almighty." Thus far is the reading of God's most holy, inerrant, and finally authoritative word. The grass withers, the flower thereof fades away, but the word of our God stands forever. And by this word is the gospel presented unto us again this day with all of its warnings and with all of its truths. And the children of Israel did evil again and again and again and again. This time they served Balaam. Even in the sight of the Lord, they served Balaam and Ashtaroth, the gods of Syria, the gods of Zidon, the gods of Moab, the gods of the children of Ammon, the gods of the Philistines. They forsook God and they served not God. And so, as a natural course, the anger of the Lord was hot against Israel, and as he had done in the past, he sells them into the hands of the Philistines, as well as into the hands of the children of Ammon. Now, the Philistine and Ammonite confederacy marks the fifth time that a nation oppressed the children of Israel. Five times now. In other words, this is the fifth time Israel apostatized, and four times before that they were delivered, and yet now they fall back into the ways of the Canaanites. So after four dramatic events of oppression upon the entire nation of Israel, they still could not learn their lesson. And so once again, God brings oppression upon the people of Israel by way of two nations, the Philistines and the children of Ammon. Now, the Ammonites were located east of the Jordan River, and like Moab and Midian, they actually were distant relatives to Israel. They were related to Israel through the same bloodline, and yet, although related, they became sworn enemies of God's people. The Philistines, on the other hand, were located on the western side of the Jordan, and so you have oppression coming from the east, and then it's coming from the west, in the same way as the judgment of God comes as lightning from the east even unto the west. And we read about that in Matthew 24. Very interesting connection. Verse 27. For as the lightning cometh out of the east and shineth even unto the west, so shall also the coming of the Son of Man be in judgment. So we have judgment coming out of the east and judgment coming out of the west. Now it is important to note that by this time Ammon had gained a substantial power base in this area. And that's why it was able to oppress Israel for 18 years without any competition from other nations. The other nation seems to have been weakened for whatever reason. But Ammon here became strengthened so that they had no competition and they were able to oppress Israel. Leon Wood makes this observation. He says, "This was clearly a time of strength for Ammon. For if the country was able to impose on Israel, indicated in the biblical records, it first would have had to attain supremacy in its own area of the southern Transjordan. This means, in particular, that it had gained ascendancy over Moab and Midian, its two perennial rivals for that portion of the land." So they had pretty much conquered everyone else, and they had become very strong, and obviously with that strength they had become very proud. It seems as if by this time everyone, by this fifth time of oppression, everyone was getting a crack at Israel. From the Moabites to the Midianites to the Ammonites to the Philistines to the children of Ammon. This was God's way of chastening Israel completely. Comprehensive chastisement. Everyone was getting a crack at oppressing Israel. Moabites, to the Midianites, to the Philistines, to the children of Ammon. It's as if God here is saying, fine, you want the ways of the heathen? You want to be like the heathen? Okay, so be it. I will give you the heathen in space. I will expose you to every sort of heathen nation and make you vulnerable to not only their oppression, but all of their wickedness, all of their idols. Because that's how God works. You want wickedness? God gives you wickedness. You want quail? God will give you enough quail that you begin to vomit it out of your mouth. Now, again, to apply this to our day, if America wants the way of the heathen, God will give them the way of the heathen. And that is what we have been seeing over the course of these many, many, many years, decades in fact. And this will continue until the nation is so polluted and oppressed by their lust for the wickedness of secular humanism, paganism and idolatry, that they will no longer be able to bear it any longer. What we are seeing in our nation is a full-fledged embracing of every kind of barbary evil to the point of where barbarism, brutality, murder, blasphemy, sodomy, tyranny, even theft is sanctioned by law. They know it's wicked, but if they can sanction it by law, it appeases their conscience, where they really don't have any conscience, but for whatever conscience is left, it is appeased. And so Israel is now brought to its knees once again. But this time, God tells them that he will not deliver them, at least not yet. In order to impress upon them the error or the depth of the error of their way, He first tells them that he is not going to deliver them and that they should go and ask their false gods to deliver them, because that's where they were going anyway. So where was God telling them to go for deliverance? Well, generally speaking, he was telling them to go to the heathen gods of the pagans, since Israel was already trusting them more than they were trusting God. In fact, not only did they trust these gods that were really no gods and not able to deliver anyone from anything whatsoever, Israel worshipped these gods. They had adopted their worship practices, their cultural tradition, their world and life view, their family structure, their educational model, their scientific instruction, and everything else that was intimately Canaanite. They became Canaanites. And the way they worshiped them was not so much by bowing down to them physically in a ritual fashion, but rather bowing down to them philosophically. In other words, Israel was placing their hope in the things that the Canaanites placed their hope in for blessings and prosperity. Israel didn't have to worship these gods in ritual format for them to be worshippers of the pagan deities. All they had to do was adopt their philosophical base. All they had to do was trust in them for their well-being and adopt their belief structure. Now, one of the major reasons behind Israel's generational continuity of apostasy, you see, you can have a generational continuity of fidelity, but you can also have a generational continuity of apostasy. And one of the reasons for this generational continuity of apostasy was through Israel's failure to educate their children Godward. Israel's future generations could never hope to stand strong against the onslaught of Canaanite influence if they were educating their children in the Canaanite education system. Education, whether it is formal or informal, whether it is active or passive, it is a powerful influence. And this is what today's American Christian fails to understand, especially when it comes to education. So where does today's American Christian go wrong? Well, sometimes I ask that question, and it's like looking at a piece of Swiss cheese, and which hole am I going to start in? Well, first, they do fail to understand the undergirding philosophy of government education, the government schools, the secular system of education. If the Christian family seeks education via the government schools, they have gone the way of the Canaanite. Period. The end. Very simple. When Jean-Jacques Rousseau came upon the scene, he wound up to be the pivotal philosopher that gave birth to our modern age, and he is often credited with the philosophy of statist education. And that is a name that you need to remember. The reprobate Jean-Jacques Rousseau, the man of revolution. William Durant, not a Christian, gave an entire volume to Rousseau in his extensive work of 965 pages when he wrote On the History of the World. One man, an entire volume. He stated, Rousseau had more effect upon posterity than any other writer or thinker of that 18th century, in which writers were more influential than they had ever been before. Kevin Swanson adds this, Rousseau's fingerprints are all over the institutions of the modern world. Schools, churches, and governments have incorporated his ideas into their organizational methodologies. The political, social, and educational institutions that provide the modern context for life on earth were very much defined by this man, end quote. You see, it was precisely Rousseau's writings that influenced John Dewey, who is credited as the father of modern education. And in the same way as in Plato's Republic, both Rousseau and Dewey believed that fathers owed their children to the state so as to be educated by the state as citizens of the state for the sole purpose of being used by the state. In this way, the biblical family would first be weakened and then ultimately destroyed in order to be replaced by the state. You see, these men were encouraging fathers to sacrifice their children to the gods of the state, undermining the only hope for a future biblical generation. And if the fathers couldn't be seduced into giving up their God-given covenant responsibility to educate their children, the state would make it compulsory by law. Siding with Plato, Rousseau, and even Karl Marx, Dewey's educational creed stated, quote, "The school is primarily a social institution. It is the regulation of the process of coming to share in the social consciousness," end quote, whatever that is. Dewey's view of education is pure statist and pure pagan. He believed that all education, all educational content, is to train the child so he or she can successfully belong to the social unit, even if that training and content is anti-biblical. In fact, he was all in for whatever was anti-biblical. Reverend Swanson says this, as he explains it. He says, "When this agenda is in place, everything else takes a back seat. Academic rigor, character training, and the fear of God. From this point on, education becomes the playground for faceless planners whose objective is to mold future society through public schools and universities. This system also drives the centralization of power in the nation's education from the local school districts into a national department of education." So it's no wonder why our nation is teetering on moral chaos and destruction. The blame must be placed, however, squarely on the churchmen, the pastors and the preachers, who refuse to warn their congregation of the dangers of the government school system, which have been manufactured by evil men with evil intentions, and have become very, very successful at what they've desired to bring about. Now, if we are to take a careful assessment of Israel's shift into extreme apostasy, we may be also to identify it as a lack of focus, a lack of recollection on God, a meditation upon His being, how He constantly cares over His people, and how we are covenantally responsible to serve Him. You see, when you put a child into a school system which is anti-Christian for 8 hours a day, there is little time to contemplate God. And then what they do when they do finally get home is they give them 2 hours of homework. So by the time the homework is finished and dinner is completed, it's time for bed. Little time for God, except maybe one Bible study on the Sunday. Or a 20-minute sermon, because the pot roast is getting cooked at home and everyone needs to rush out to eat it. They have become very, very successful. So there's no longer a focus upon the deep things of life and the deep things of God. And this is a second reason for Israel's departure from God. They no longer had focused upon God. They were all about what was happening in Canaan. If there was something new in Canaan, we wanted to be part of it. If there was something new here, we needed to have a piece of it. To focus upon God amidst the shifting sand of modernity is perhaps one of the most challenging things a child of God could do, especially in our day and age. Especially this is true in our time, in our day of extreme and intrusive technology. You see, whenever a people lose sight of their center, they become like everything around them. Israel lost their center by taking their eye off of it and looking longingly at Canaanites and the Canaanite world around them and what the Canaanites had, what the Canaanites did. They wanted to be so much like them that they adopted everything that was about them, their education system, their technology. They adopted their worship. And once that happened, they began to look more and more like Canaan and less like God's people. Look at the worship today around you. What is it like? What is the majority of Christian worship light today? It's entertainment, 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 and more entertainment, because it's just like Canaan. Because Canaanites are all about entertainment. Israel lost all sense of direction. And they lost all distinction between what God had purposed for them and for what they had become. and everything became blurred. They were synthesized into the world of Canaan, and they didn't even know it. They didn't even know it. Their lives were being destroyed, and they didn't even know it until it was too late. Now, we don't know what the Canaanites did to entice Israel. Well, maybe they didn't do anything. Maybe they just were Canaanites. We really don't know if they really did anything at all but to live as heathen people. If the remaining Canaanite common folk were crafty, however, they would have done anything and everything to make peace with Israel after they were conquered by Joshua so as not to be too harshly treated. But peace with the enemy always results in the compromising of those who would make peace with their enemy. The Canaanites may have secretly tried to seduce Israel with whatever they had at their disposal in order to corrupt them into the way of the heathen. Their end goal, of course, was not so much the seduction of Israel. That was the method. The end goal was the corruption of Israel. That was the end goal. So the seduction is, hey, we could teach your children in our government schools. But the goal is a corruption. You see, if Canaan could only refocus Israel by distraction, then they could substitute their way for God's way. Then they would be successful. That was their plan. Distraction, then substitution. It was that simple. Now, here's what we know. First, the Canaanites had great farmlands. Their agricultural methods produced much which they ascribed to their gods and goddesses of the pagan world. Technologically, in the area of agriculture, they were well advanced beyond Israel. Remember, Israel, they were shepherds. They weren't farmers. And perhaps they said, well, you know, you could be agriculturally benefited by worshiping our gods, and then you too can have rich farmlands. So when Israel entered into Canaan, they were not an agrarian people, and they looked to Canaan to teach them. Second problem when Israel went into Canaan is the Canaanites, they had beautiful women. If the Canaanites could get their young virgins to marry the young men of Israel, they could easily seduce them into compliance. They didn't need to conquer Israel through military might. They simply needed only to conquer Israel through intermarriage procreation. What Israel failed to understand and what God had warned them about was that these women would be instrumental in shifting their Israeli husbands from Yahweh to the gods and goddesses of the groves. And since these women would be predominantly in charge of the raising and educating of the children, they then could control the future. Because those who control the education control the child and ultimately the future. By instilling the pagan philosophy, whatever pagan philosophy they wanted, they would in turn control the future generations. This is one of the reasons why Israel could not maintain a continuity of fidelity for more than two generations at a time. They kept falling prey to the beauty of the Canaanite world. Third, in the past, the Canaanite had built great cities, and it seemed as if Israel was impressed by them. And this too was an impressive technological advancement that may have taken Israel's breath away. Yet, whenever we read of the cities in scriptures, they usually were the hotbed of paganism. A fourth point, the Canaanites also had great armies. This too was impressive. And this is what Israel longed for. They wanted a king like the other nations so that he could be a military force for security, building an army, and giving them peace of mind through military force. So the question is this. How is the American Christian, well, let me put it another way. How is the American professing individual of the Christian faith, other than in the area of education, how are they following the same pattern as the nation of Israel in their apostasy, other than education? How has Christendom been distracted? And how is that distraction into worldliness been substituted for piety and obedience? But before we look at the way Christians are distracted to the point of substituting Baal for Christ, we should understand what is the root of the Christian life. What is the root of the Christian life? What does it mean to be a Christian? What does it mean to live the Christian life? Reiterating the law of God, the Lord Jesus Christ says this, "And thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thine heart, with all thy soul, with all thy mind, with all thy strength. This is the first commandment, and the second is like, namely this, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. There is none other commandment greater than these." The idea of loving one's neighbor is only accomplished through action. It is an actionable commandment which requires human communication and human interaction. And I stress the word human. Behind the call to this action is the presupposition that your neighbor is created in the image of God in the very same way that you are created in the image of God. In other words, God is pointing to a human element of communication. In other words, you and your neighbor share the same humanity. And because you both share the same humanity, which is a godly image, that humanity is sacred, and it must be treated as sacred. And it is this humanness that makes us God's image bearers. The idea of humans bearing God's image is declared by the Lord when referring to little children. But the principle is the same for all flesh. Notice what he says in Matthew 18:10. "Take heed that ye despise not one of these little ones, for I say unto you, that in heaven their angels do always behold the face of my Father which is in heaven." Once that humanness is lost, we are on the fast track to gross apostasy. Secondly, Christianity is based upon Christian discipline and Christian discipleship. Every Christian is called to be a disciple of Christ, and it is the life of Christ that is set up for us as our example. Christ interacted with the people, face-to-face, human conditions. And so whenever we read of the life of Christ, we see him communicating the truth of God's word face-to-face with others. When God spoke directly with his prophets, he did so with the intention that they would speak to the people face to face, human being to human being. So Christian discipleship, to be truly Christian, it must maintain that human connection. This is precisely why the Lord tells us to go to our brother whenever there is a disagreement. Don't call him on the phone. Don't send him a text. Don't put him on a group chat. You go to the individual face to face. Moreover, he says, "If thy brother shall trespass against thee, go and tell him his fault between thee and thee." Go and tell him face to face. "If he shall hear thee, thou hast gained thy brother." In my 27 years of pastoring, this is the most neglected commandment by churchgoers, which has been the single most destroying factor of Christendom. The Apostle Paul goes one step further by reminding the Galatians that we are all human and therefore must treat each other as human image bearers of God. Notice what he says to the church at Galatia in chapter 6, verse 1. "Brethren, if a man be overtaken in a fault, ye which are mature or spiritual, restore such an one in the spirit of meekness, considering thyself, lest thou also be tempted." And he wasn't telling them to send them a letter. So what exactly has caused modern Christianity to lose its connection to humanity and its humanness? Because I could tell you this, friends, we have lost our connection with humanity, with humanness. Well, first, the government school has single-handedly severed the relationship between parent and child and between children of different ages. So instead of becoming more socially mature, the product of secular education has made the child more isolated and less apt to relate to other human beings that are not of his or her peer group. Obviously, this is broken humanity. But obviously, for the schools, this broken humanity was incomplete. It wasn't broken enough. Enter technology. You want to sever man from man? Relationships from one another completely? Expose mankind to the onslaught of technology. You see, you can't get away from it. We live in a technological age, a technologically dominant society. Whether we know it or not, we are overwhelmingly affected by technology to the point where at this point in time, in this present dispensation, we can no longer live effectively without technology. It has become our connection to everything, to all things, people, places, information, entertainment, and shopping. And what this technology has done, it has successfully... Now, not all technology is bad, and if we use it properly, it can be really good. But I'm talking about the negative impact. What this technology negatively has done, it has successfully brought us to the point of transition. In other words, it's brought us to a point of transitioning from our humanists to what Professor Ben Mitchell of the Department of Moral Philosophy at the Union University calls post-human. We're becoming post-human. He explains it this way. He says, during the remainder of this century, we will increasingly have the potential to alter the future, not just of individuals, but of the entire human species. Genetic augmentation, artificial intelligence, robotics, and other technologies will either serve a truly human future or human beings will serve those technologies. According to many transhumanists, we are transitional humans on our way to becoming post-humans. What does he mean by transhumanism? Well, transhumanism is defined as faith in technology to vastly expand the capabilities of human beings. Faith in technology, not in God. Notice the shift. But faith in technology, faith in science, to vastly explain and expand the capabilities of humans. But the real question is, to what end? Why have we had this transition? What end? To what end are we expanding the capabilities of human beings? Is it just to have more choices? Certainly, technology gives us more choices, more entertainment, more gadgets, more devices attached to our bodies. I even use one. But to what end? Some of the advocates of this movement are Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg and Google's co-founders, Sergey Brin and Larry Page. Transhumanism, while it appears to be non-threatening and going in a non-threatening direction, even promising an exciting future, is actually a life's philosophy. And certainly, technology promises an exciting future. I've heard it stated that the future looks more futuristic than we ever could have imagined. Very exciting. The potential because of technology is overwhelming. But it's actually a life's philosophy, which has become an incredibly powerful intellectual and cultural movement, which has already irreversibly affected most every human being on the face of the planet. Transhumanism transforms. Transhumanism is the process. Posthumanism is the goal. It is a movement away from what it means to be a human being in the biblical sense. And so it is not only very likely that this slide into technological transhumanism changes us, it ultimately will strip us of our humanness. And the reason for this is because transhumanism is not only a process, but it is a worldview. And that's what you have to understand. Transhumanism is a worldview that is rooted in secularism and the quest to be as God. Jacob Schatzer explains it this way. Transhumanism rejects the supernatural and has notes of transcendentalism echoing throughout. Instead, transhumanism emphasizes that we discover meaning and ethics via reason, progress, and the value of existence itself. Its philosophy finds its roots in Enlightenment humanism, a la Jean-Jacques Rousseau. Karl Marx, Dewey, Descartes, and the rest of those anti-Christian reprobates. He continues, its philosophy finds its roots in Enlightenment humanism. Enlightenment humanism tended to focus on education and cultural refinement as a means to improve the human condition. But transhumanism uses reason, advanced technology, and science to creatively transform human nature. Enlightenment humanism promoted themes of progress, personal autonomy, and acting rather than relying on supernatural forces. Transhumanism expands humanism's tool belt by extending beyond education and cultural refinement to applying technology for the purpose of overcoming limits that humans bump up against. It enables us to overcome our biological and genetic inheritance. According to this perspective, human nature is not a static, unchanging thing, but a point on a pathway of development. Therefore, transhumanism's goal is not the ideal human of the Enlightenment humanism, but something that transcends what we would currently label human, end quote. And so by trying to become more human via technology, transhumanism actually makes us less human and ultimately less humane. What the Canaanites did to Israel was alienate them from God with their technology, which was rooted in their pagan worldview. It made them less human in the biblical sense, and they were able to adopt every wickedness that was available to them from Canaan. You see, alienation is the first step to total forgetfulness, which God over and over accused Israel of. Technology will alienate us from one another and ultimately from God if it is not used properly. Author Michael Harris sees this very clearly. Notice what he says, very serious and very simple. He says, every technology will alienate you from some part of your life. That is its job. Your job is to notice, end quote. In order for Israel or any other people to shift covenant allegiances, they first must be alienated from those allegiances. Are you having trouble relating to your wife, or your husband, or your son, or your daughter, or your mother, or your father? Maybe it's the technology that is alienating you and putting you in this box so that you become post-human. See, Israel didn't wake up one day and say, gee, we should repudiate our covenant with Jehovah and make a new covenant with Baal. They didn't just wake up one day and say that. Their apostasy came by degrees. They didn't even know what was happening to them. They first had to be made to believe that a covenant with Baal was acceptable to Jehovah. If I stay on my technological device all day long, 24/7, this way, that way, 7 days a week, I guess if I believe this is acceptable with God because I'm also reading the Bible on my smartphone, then everything's fine and you're being alienated without even knowing it. This is what happened to Israel. The human mind has to first be changed in order for it to entertain such an idea that a covenant with Baal is acceptable to Jehovah. In the same way that Christians today believe that it is acceptable to send their children to government schools, and they'll argue with you tooth and nail that the government schools, it's the way to go, but they haven't a clue because of their ignorance, the depth of their ignorance and the depth of their arrogant insanity, not knowing the root and the branch where government education has come from, they will argue tooth and nail for the glory of the government schools, or they will argue that they are allowing, and it's a good thing to allow the children to watch countless hours of television, video games, or social media exposure. They will argue and argue and argue. And yet they don't even understand what it is doing to not only their family, themselves, but the culture itself. Just because you can do something, just because something is made available to us, it doesn't mean we should do it. Doesn't mean simply because we have a smartphone, we should be always on the smartphone. or simply because we can do these things technologically, that we should do these things, because technology in and of itself changes us. To be sure, it changes us. But digital technology is particularly damaging because of how deeply immersed mankind has become to rely upon it. You think about it. Just think about it. Tell me if I'm wrong. How do you feel when you leave your smartphone home? I know you turn around that vehicle and you drive home and you get it. You feel as if you're detached from reality. You're detached from life. Oh no, I left my smartphone home. What if you couldn't chat? What if you couldn't email? Or look up the weather on your phone? Or even use your telephone? How would you feel about that? How would you research a topic without using a Google search engine? I don't know. Do you even remember how to use a book? Do you even know how to research a topic using books? Do you know what an index is for? Today's grade school children now, because the alienation was not enough in captivating them for 8 hours a day, now they're given computer tablets with the excuse that they will learn better. So what if you couldn't use a calculator? Could you add and subtract, multiply and divide? Would you even attempt to balance your checkbook without QuickBooks on your PC? What if you were deprived of your television or your computer? Could you function? Now, I know sometimes we use it for business, and it's fine. Remember, there's a positive aspect. You see, all these things, for good or for evil, have changed us. We have to admit at least that. They've changed us. They've become part of us. Some for the better, some for the worse. Digital technology pulls us away from people by setting up walls of bits and bytes instead of face-to-face human interaction. That's what we have to be mindful of. We cannot neglect our humanness when it comes to talking with people. We can't always rely on technology. You see, digital technology, in fact, it pulls us away from what is real. We used to be able to define what is real by those things that we see or experience. Today, we have something else. It's called virtual reality, which means it's not really real. And that notion is what is real and what is not is shoved down our throats by movies such as The Matrix and others, along with sci-fi novels. This is real, this is not. Virtual reality has made such inroads in our technological thrust that many who partake of this venue have trouble identifying, after they've had a long exposure to it, what is real and what is fantasy. Now, you know what virtual technology is. You put on a goggle and you see things as if they're real, and then you're acting them out in the air, but you're really experiencing that thing that's going into your mind. And after a long exposure, you forget what is real and what isn't real. Video games also have this effect on people as well. Virtual reality has made such inroads that many people who partake of that venue have trouble identifying what is real and what is fantasy. Schatzer observes, he says, virtual reality not only expands what people consider real, using these tools also affects the way we understand the real world in profound ways. Virtual reality changes the perception of the real because people spend a lot of time in virtual worlds having significant experiences that then shape the way they live in the real world. End quote. Why do you think we're having all of these gun violence shootings? Because they're exposing themselves to the virtual world and it's not real, so they're going to act it out in the real world, and then it's very different because it's now it's blood and guts. When we have significant experiences, they shape the way we think and live in the real world. And this phenomena was true with movies to a certain extent, but now with the advent of virtual reality experience, the problem has increased exponentially. Just think about it. Have you ever had a dream that seemed so real that you weren't sure if it was real or not? Or did you ever have this deja vu moment where you're thinking, gee, did this really happen to me? Or was that a dream that I had that it happened? Did you really say that to me? Or was that a dream that I dreamed that you said that to me? You see, we even have trouble there dissecting whether or not it was real or fantasy or a dream. And of course, the way you figure that it was a dream and not reality is because you knew you were asleep, or you realized that you were still in bed when you woke up. But then when you have that deja vu experience, you're not even sure. Was I really thinking that? Did I really, that really happen? Did she really say that? Did he really do that? With virtual reality, you are awake. And what you're experiencing is real in the moment. And it is then ingrained in your mind. Eventually, it becomes real to you. And what is so sinister about this type of technology is that it appears to connect us to more and more people in an easy and seamless fashion, while at the same time disconnecting us to those very same people, because it strips us of our human interaction. Cara Platoni, in her book titled, "We Have the Technology, How Biohackers, Foodies, Physicians, and Scientists Are Transforming Human Perception One Sense at a Time." That's the name of the book. She says this: "Virtual reality offers an incredibly powerful way to wrap yourself in that imaginary landscape. It is perhaps the earliest and most potent example of a computer technology specifically designed to alter sense perception. As the field has matured, it's provided fascinating insights into what happens as we merge our senses with the electronic world. It's shown that we react physiologically, emotionally, and intellectually to the virtual world as we do our own, even carrying those feelings and behaviors into ordinary life. Around the world, virtual reality labs are running that ball in opposite directions. Some work to create even more fantastical bodies and terrains, defying physics and biology to see how readily the brain adapts to novel experiences." End quote. We are lab rats if we don't recognize what is going on. And so what happens when we immerse ourselves in virtual reality or video games or digital communications to a large extent is we lose our human connection with one another, while at the same time thinking that we are establishing communion. Oh, look, I'm talking with someone from Istanbul. Are you really communicating, or are you just writing letters back and forth? Is that human connecting? Or in playing a video game with someone in China, or I'm on a chat with everyone and we're just conversing. Is that ministry? Jesus Christ was among the people. He is our example. Paul himself, he longed to see the brethren face to face. He didn't send them letters only when it was important. When he couldn't be there, he didn't have the plane, trains, and automobiles. He longed to see the brethren face to face. Letters weren't enough because they disconnected the apostle from the human interaction that to him was so precious. Technological communication desensitizes us to the imago Dei, in other words, the image of God in our brethren and others who bear God's image. And once that happens, we no longer can conduct Christian discipleship as God would have it. You see, you cannot love your neighbor as yourself from a smartphone or by playing video games. Loving your neighbor means connecting with your neighbor human to human. And this is what it means to be a Christian. Okay, so how is the Canaanite influence over Israel similar to the technological influence over American Christianity? Well, the Canaanites convinced Israel that if they accepted their way of living, they could be free to control the outcome of their world. The Canaanite world was theirs to be controlled. The Canaanite gods were theirs to control. Just give them what they want, and they will give you in return what you want. And so perhaps unknowingly, Israel saw a chance to be his God. They saw a chance to use nature to advance their situation of life in the same way today's mankind now sees a chance to control nature and their life situation via technology. And by embracing the Canaanite worldview, Israel was able to feed into their earthly nature. They could be free. They could now self-actualize. They could now recreate themselves into the image of a Superman. Mostly, they could now define for themselves what they wanted to be. And this is what is now known as Morphological freedom. Morphological freedom belongs to the transhumanistic agenda. Morphological freedom declares this, quote, since science and technology makes it possible to do a thing, I then have the freedom to choose that thing, regardless of whether the thing is ethical, good, or evil. Since it is possible, I can have it. I could be a man. I could be a woman. I could be a bridge. I could be a dog. I could be a cat. I could do this. I could do that. I could be anything I want because it's possible. Divorced from all ethics. Because it's possible, I can have it. And because it's possible, I have the right to have it. That's where we are today. Since we can now change our physical bodies to be whatever we desire, we should have the right to do so no matter what the cost and no matter what the consequence. Or since we now have laws that sanction all kinds of evil, we should be free to obey those laws. Schatzer explains this mindset further. He says, so why do transhumanists want morphological freedom? Because their very understanding of what it means to be human is to transform and change and evolve. Now, while there are some aspects of morphological freedom that are positive, especially in the area of medical science and healing medicine, like everything else, once man gets a hold of it, it quickly turns to evil. Once the morphological freedom righteous people want becomes commonplace, they will turn it into evil. And what the transhumanist movement is achieving, and might I add, without us even knowing it and without even our help, they are changing the notion of relationships. Imagine for a minute. Imagine just for a moment a virtual Lord's Supper. A virtual Lord's Supper celebration. Would it be permissible? Would it be permissible without human contact or communion? I mean, it's called communion. Could we do it via the internet? Would that be orthodox? Would that be sanctioned by God's word? Imagine a virtual church where there's no human interaction or where there's no human accountability, which is what most people want. Or where technology is the primary focus of worship. So you have big screens, projectors, lights, cameras, actions, big bands, theater, goats, cows, chickens, and everything else. Is that permissible? Maybe they'll just be virtual goats, chickens, and cows. Would these be considered valid worship models? I don't think so. In fact, I know so. They will not be acceptable. Theologian Craig Bartholomew posits, he says this, God has made creation to be a home for humans. In the beginning, God created the heaven and earth for man to dwell in it in relationship and communion with him and with one another. Again, Schatzer explains further. He says, we must recognize limits. True eschatology reminds us that we do not seek an escape from the world. We are about its renewal to become the new heaven and the new earth. In other words, Christians hope for renewal of creation, not rejection of creation in favor of something else. A.K.A. the virtual world of technology. The Christian cannot long survive existing in a virtual world. The cultivation of Christian charity, think about that, cannot be achieved via social media or through email. It must be done face to face. What transhumanism seeks is the destruction of this communion, which ultimately will lead to the death of biblical Christianity. You see, Israel lost its perspective on reality. They lost their perspective on what it meant to be human, created in God's image. They were distracted by the Canaanite culture to the point where they substituted Baal for God, and they never asked themselves, not one minute, what kind of culture they were embracing and what kind of humans they were becoming because of it. May we never lose our perspective on what is real and what is not. And may we, by the grace of God, seek for the old paths where the good way is, and walk therein. And this we shall do, God helping us, unto the praise of the glory of his grace. Amen.